This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest David Troyer says only three Native American languages now spoken in the U.S. and Canada are expected to survive into the middle of this century. His language, Ojibwe, is one of them. It's spoken by about 10,000 people in the Great Lakes region. David Troyer and his brother Anton, both members of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe Indians, are fluent Ojibwe speakers who believe more than words are lost when a language dies. They're working on a project to record, transcribe, and translate their language in the hope it will still be spoken centuries from now. Anton Troyer teaches at Bemidji State University in Minnesota and is editor of the Oshkawibis Native Journal, a collection of stories in the Ojibwe language. David Troyer teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Minnesota. His third novel, The Translation of Dr. Apelles, was published earlier this year. Well, David Troyer and Anton Troyer, welcome to Fresh Air. David, you recently wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times about your efforts to preserve the Ojibwe language. And you write that if this language dies, not just words, but many understandings will disappear. What do you mean? Give us an example of that.
Well, for example, in the article I talked about the word for mukwa, or word for bear, is derived from another word, makuk, which means box. So inherent or inside the word for bear is the concept that they hibernate or box themselves up for winter. And that's just one of many examples, and this is true for any language, an example of how concepts live inside of words and live through them. And if the words die, well, then the concepts will probably die too.
Yeah, Anton, what's something that, when said in Ojibwe, can never quite be recreated in English?
One thing that's very different for Ojibwe is that the roots of words are known to everyday speakers. And although there are roots to words in the English language, they often come from Latin or the Germanic roots of language and are not known to everyday speakers. So one thing that happens with Ojibwe is that people are communicating on two levels. There are the words and the things or actions they're associated with, and then the deeper meanings as well. A couple examples come to mind would be in Ojibwe, the word we have for an elder, Gichiaya'a, literally means a great being. And the word we have for an elderly woman, Mindemuye, literally means one who holds things together and describes the role of the family matriarch. In English, you have words like elderly woman, aged woman, old woman, and no wonder everybody wants to dye their hair, get a facelift, a Botox injection, and won't admit how old they really are in the English-speaking world. But in Ojibwe, you have a different concept of age and gender that comes across in the language very clearly.
So in a way, the kind of development and evolution of the language is contained within the word because you have the root and then the way it's expanded to embrace a different meaning?
Right. And it also means that it's easy for fluent Ojibwe speakers to make new words for new things. So when a television set came along, they didn't have to borrow a loan word from English. They could create another one that is intrinsically Ojibwe. They call Mazanate Sijigan, or a box that reflects an image through light. Could just describe what they saw.
You know, David, you write in this piece in the LA Times that there's this woman, Anna Gibbs, whose Ojibwe name means the way the moonlight will wrinkle on the water on an almost still night. And I guess what's interesting to me about that is that in English we certainly have the word for moonlight, but is Ojibwe a language in which there are far more and varied descriptions of natural beauty and phenomena? I mean, many, many ways to talk about moonlight?
Well, I suppose there is. I mean, it's a language is, you know, grows along certain lines. Every language does, and Ojibwe language needed to be very precise when describing, especially weather phenomenon, in particular, weather and water. In the Great Lakes region, those are the two most important forces that are going to shape your life. So, yeah, we have many, many, many words that deal with those concepts with a kind of precision that is astounding to me.
Yeah. Anton, you want to add to something? Is there another word for water that has a functional meaning in the life of Ojibwe?
Well, there are so many words for water in different ways to speak about precipitation, the way that a wave looks, sounds. There's a lot of nuanced meaning and understanding that is embedded in the language. And I think David's very accurate when he's saying this was shaped in large part by the fact that people got their food from the land and often from the water. And so Ojibwe people living in that area, of course, had to be able to describe and understand everything that was going on around them.
So fishing or trapping or hunting or gathering wild rice might be very different in different climactic or conditions. So they needed to be communicated in a much more precise way?
Sure. There were high mortality rates. People went fishing on thin ice. They, in the fall and in the spring, they went fishing when the water was extremely cold. When there were certain types of waves, they were more dangerous or less dangerous. In Ojibwe, a root B would pertain to water or precipitation. And so just to give you an example, just with the precipitation terms, you get a wanibisa, meaning there's a fine sprinkling like a mist. You get words where you have bungibisa, where the water's starting to fall in larger droplets, nichibisa, where you get a heavy rain. And all of these are different verbs in Ojibwe, rather than using one word for water or rain and other adjectives to describe. They're all separate words.
Why is this language threatened?
It's the same process that threatens many, many languages. First and foremost, there was a government policy of language eradication beginning in the late 19th century and stretching through the first half of the 20th, wherein Native people were not only not encouraged to speak their native languages, they were penalized for doing so, penalized in their communities, penalized at boarding schools. Many Ojibwe children and many Indian children across the country and Canada were forced into residential schools where their languages were forbidden. Another reason is sort of the march of English across the linguistic landscape, where it's every bit of noise you hear, every bit of linguistic noise is in English, at least in America, from TV to instant messaging to conversation on the street. And you don't walk down the street and hear somebody speaking Ojibwe, not in New York City, not in Minneapolis so often, not in Omaha, Nebraska.
What about on the reservation? So, yeah, I mean, do the kids there speak it, and or are they being assimilated into mainstream American culture?
Oh, not so much our reservation, exactly. Our reservation, most of the kids speak English, except for these children who are going into these immersion language programs. And they're becoming Ojibwe speakers, which is very heartening.
You know, Anton, I was going to ask you if you would to pick one of the stories that's recorded and translated in the Oshkabewish Journal, this translation of stories told in Ojibwe. Pick one that you like and then maybe tell us what moves you about it.
Okay. Let's see here. Well, here's a story by Joe Oganosh, which appears in Living Our Language, and it's titled Gawin Gwanitu Simen Gidin Wewinanan, means we're not losing our language. And he spoke this, and I transcribed and translated, and it reads as follows. Ha ganabaj gwanitumen ikidung anishinabe ish chigen gwanitumen gawin ganabaj iwanishinabe mun keabi ayamagat migo gine wind etago gwanishinimen okenegego gwanitumen anishinabe ish chigewinan minawago anishinabe gapish chigewar miwinsha keabi ma ayamagat. And in this section, Joe Oganosh is saying that people are saying that we are losing our language, but I don't think we're losing our language. I think, on the other hand, our language is losing us, that our language is still here, it is still fluently spoken, it is still known by many people, but it is us who are lost. It is us who are not valuing and using and working to preserve our language, and in doing so, we are the ones who are lost.
David Troyer, you recently wrote in this piece in the LA Times, you described an experience that you had when you were fishing for walleye in a traditional Ojibwe way and had a moment which sort of brought home to you the importance of preserving this language and culture. Could you describe that moment?
Yeah, the moment occurred when I was spearing walleye with two guys from Le Coudray Reservation in Wisconsin. And it's dark, it's foggy, and you do it in the middle of the night with headlights. So the eyes of the walleye glow in the dark, and you coast along in shallow water spearing fish. And it's a pleasant thing to do. It's cold, but it's fun. You're with your friends, and you're providing food for people, and the food's given out to whoever needs it. And we're busy fishing, talking quietly, and I can hear televisions on. coming from houses on the shore, houses owned by non-native people. And I can hear Leno and I can hear Letterman. And I felt very strongly that we were doing something, that my friends and I, we were actually doing something for others, doing something for ourselves, in comparison to the sort of passive acceptance, you know, coming through the televisions.
You two have an interesting background. You were not born on the reservation. Tell us about your parents.
Well, our parents are, you know, I guess I'm one of the few people that actually both loves and respects his parents, and I feel grateful for them. Our father is Austrian by birth, and he escaped with his parents to the United States in 1938, Austrian and Jewish, and he and his parents escaped the Holocaust. Most of the family died in concentration camps. And through a series of life accidents, entirely too complicated to recount here, he wound up on the reservation where he met our mother, who's Ojibwe from the reservation. She's grew up in a very poor family in a sort of stereotypically tiny log cabin with no running water, no indoor plumbing, just electricity. Grew up very poor. And anyway, so they married, and they had us and had our younger brother and sister, and we were all raised together on the reservation.
And Anton, so you were raised in Washington by the Jewish father and the Ojibwe mother. And what prompted you to move to the reservation?
Well, actually, we were born in Washington, D.C., but raised primarily in northern Minnesota,
okay,
both on and near Leech Lake Ojibwe Reservation. So I had an interesting experience of being connected to place at home, but also feeling a certain level of disconnect. And for me, really, I feel like I knew who I was when I rediscovered the Ojibwe language. And I did have the honor and pleasure of hearing a lot of Ojibwe when I grew up. My mother carted us off to ceremonies and made sure we had exposure to those things. But I don't think that I truly valued anything that I was exposed to of my Ojibwe language and heritage until I was much older.
You spoke English at home?
Well, we spoke English primarily at home. Although my mother did use the Ojibwe language to the degree of her ability, and then also made sure we had exposure at ceremonies and so forth. But it was really when I left the reservation, when I went to college, where I felt like I was a minority for the first time, or in that way, that I started to think about and value the things I'd been exposed to as a child and really appreciate them. And then as I delve deeper, really rediscover the importance and the beauty of the Ojibwe language.
I'm wondering whether you have a sense of being Jewish from your father's heritage. Was Hebrew or Yiddish ever spoken around the house?
No. In fact, our father's family were pretty well, I guess the word is, assimilated Jews in Vienna. They saw themselves as socialists first, mm-hmm, before anything else, and they're very political people, not observant at all. So I never considered myself Jewish. I didn't really know any other Jewish people growing up, and I finally, you know, met some other Jewish people in college. That was the real discovery. In college, I had a friend who didn't know what to call me or to call Anton. He said, "Well, you're half Jewish, you're half native. I don't know what to call you." He goes, "Oh, wait, I know. I'll call you Running Bernstein." and he did for 3 years of college, called me Running Bernstein.
And were you offended?
No, he was a funny guy. He was half Greek and half African American, and he called himself Afro-Grecian. So no, I was not offended.
You mentioned that your father, you know, was an Austrian Jew who was fairly assimilated, and that as he came, you know, to the United States, it sounds as if his sort of attachment to his traditional culture largely disappeared. And I wondered if in some way that affected your own sense of commitment to, you know, preserve your attachment to Ojibwe language and culture.
It did. Our father is an amazing guy. He's really an astounding man. And he worked for decades and decades on the reservation with Native people, with Ojibwe people, our reservation and many others in Minnesota. And unlike a lot of people of his generation or of his cultural background, he had the most profound, and still does, had the most profound appreciation for Native ways. And he supported our mother, he supported Anton, and He supported me, our other siblings, many other Native people in their efforts to preserve language and their efforts to preserve culture and ceremony. And so in that way, he had an amazing influence on us. He valued our lives.
You know, we're just about out of time, but I thought I would ask you, you know, as you've both spent some time now really entering the world of linguistics and this effort to, you know, preserve the Ojibwe language, you've also become aware of the challenges of preserving it and you know, the obstacles that traditional languages face in surviving in a modern world. Are you more or less optimistic that 100 years from now, people will still be speaking Ojibwe? Anton?
I am more optimistic. You know, I've often heard people worry and speak about how, you know, we're losing our language or we're losing our culture. But to me, what amazes me more than anything else is how much we still have. That, in fact, we still have a beautiful language that is still spoken over a wide swath of territory from Quebec to Saskatchewan and in the United States from Michigan out to Montana. And in addition to having our language, we still have all of our major religious ceremonies and customs. And it might seem that we hang on to these things by thin threads at times, but we are hanging on to them. And then when I turn and I look at David's daughter, Elsina, for example, and I held up a stuffed rabbit for her, she looked and she said, oh, Wabus! Pew, pew! And she made a shooting sound and pointed her finger at it. And identified it and spoke, you know, the Ojibwe word for it. And I thought, you know what? She's not only learning her language, but she's also learning about Ojibwe life ways, that hunting and gathering and making our own food is acceptable and preferable. And at age 2, she was already showing the signs and the hope that not only our language, but our life ways will be continuing.
David?
I feel the same way. And if you look 30, 35, 40 years ago, young Native people from all over the country were becoming very political, and a lot of them joined the American Indian Movement. They thought that effecting institutional change was the way to help Indian people. And they may have been right. But you look around today, the same young people who would have joined political movements are turning their attention not outward but inward. They're turning back toward self-improvement, toward language revitalization, toward ceremonial revitalization, not just Ojibwe people, but young Native people from many, many different tribes. They're not trying to change the government's mind. That's still important. But they're trying to change their own minds. So I'm very hopeful. And I believe in the power of our language, and I believe in the power of our people to keep it alive.
Well, David Troyer, Anton Troyer, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
David Troyer teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Minnesota. His third novel, The Translation of Dr. Apelles, has just been published. Anton Troyer teaches at Bemidji State University in Minnesota.